Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Jason Palmer, one of the hosts of The Intelligence, The Economist's daily current affairs podcast. The Economist's award-winning shows make sense of what matters, from our special series on China's president to our weekly podcasts on business, technology, and American politics, our journalists provide fair, in-depth reporting on the events shaping the world. Search for Economist Podcasts Plus and sign up to our free one-month trial.
Take a walk in somebody else's shoes with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe. Search for the documentary Lives Less Ordinary and Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Are you ready for some magic?
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 1st of January, these are our main stories. A powerful earthquake strikes Japan.
In areas where the shaking was strong, there's an increased risk of house collapses and landslides. So please be careful and do not enter dangerous areas.
Thousands flee to higher ground after tsunami warnings. The Israeli military says it's killed a senior Hamas commander in an overnight raid in Gaza. And a celebrated Nobel Peace Laureate gets 6 months in prison in Bangladesh. Also in this podcast...
What if something happens to a man? An aggressive man can assault another man. That's not good either. Violence isn't always gender-based or sexualized. It can simply be some kind of an idiot.
Ukrainian railways are bringing in female-only compartments, but not everyone is on board. We start in Japan, which has been hit by a series of earthquakes in the west central region. Buildings shook and people reacted in panic. The authorities issued tsunami warnings and told people in affected areas to move to shelters or to higher ground and warned them to be cautious in the coming days. And the effects were felt far from the epicentre. Jeffrey Hall is a lecturer at Japan's Kanda University. He described how he felt the earthquake hundreds of kilometres away.
I'm all the way over right now in Yokohama on the other side of Japan's main island. But at around 4 p.m., I could feel heavy shaking about 2 minutes long. And I could tell, even though it wasn't near me, that this was a big earthquake. It was the exact same experience I had in Tokyo when the 3.11 earthquake hit over 10 years ago. You just feel something is very long and you know that this has been a terrible earthquake somewhere, but not close.
I got the latest from our former Tokyo correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes.
From the pictures coming out from late this afternoon in local time, we're starting to see the extent of the damage, and it is very extensive. Major structural damage to major highways, to bridges, to infrastructure. There have been landslides. Many older buildings in the Ishikawa, in the Noto Peninsula area, appear to have come down. People are reportedly still trapped underneath the collapsed buildings. We're getting reports of many people being brought into local hospitals injured. So this is a very, very large earthquake. The biggest I have seen, with the largest shaking, certainly since that enormous quake hit Japan back in 2011. So this is a very serious disaster. And I think it won't be until daybreak tomorrow that we really start to see the full extent of the damage that has been done up on the northwest coast there of Japan.
And we're hearing that the authorities have downgraded warnings of tsunamis, but there was a worry about big waves earlier, wasn't there?
There was a real worry. They were warning that the whole of that coast could have come under a 5-metre tsunami in the immediate aftermath of the quake. And, of course, that again brought back memories of 2011 when a 15-metre tsunami hit the northeast coast of Japan and did massive destruction. That is still part of the collective memory and the collective trauma in Japan, what happened back in 2011. So people will have seen those warnings and thought, this is it again. And people will have moved to higher ground. They will have fled their homes and got out away from the coast as soon as they could. That warning has now been lifted, although it still remains in effect for parts of Korea and the far east of Russia. But there will be huge relief in Japan that tsunami has not not come to pass.
You mentioned this massive earthquake in March 2011. No doubt lots of lessons were learnt about emergency planning after that earthquake.
Lots of lessons were learned. A lot of infrastructure was reinforced, particularly power plants. There was new tsunami walls built along the northeast coast. But of course, this is the different coast. And this is a coast which experiences far fewer earthquakes than the east coast of Japan, which is on the so-called Pacific Rim of Fire by the deep trench that divides Asia from the Pacific Plate. So actually, the Noto Peninsula is not well known for having lots of large earthquakes. And so I think the buildings there were probably less well prepared and less strengthened than they would have been in Tokyo or along the east coast of Japan, which has frequent earthquakes and where the construction standards are very high.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. The Israeli Defense Force says it has killed a senior Hamas commander believed to be behind one of the attacks on southern Israel on the 7th of October. Adil Musama led the Nukba Hamas force, which attacked the Kesufim kibbutz. The IDF report came as Israeli forces continued their assault on Gaza. Hamas, though, is still fighting. It's released videos showing dozens of rockets it launched from Gaza towards Israel overnight, setting off air raid sirens in southern and central Israel. I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yoland Nell, to tell me a little more about Adil Musama and what the IDF has had to say.
According to the Israeli military, he was a locally important Hamas commander in Deir Balah in the centre of the Gaza Strip, who led one of the groups from this elite Nukba force that carried out one of the attacks on the 7th of October. And they say he also directed some Hamas fighters to go to other communities that are along the border, to Biri and to Nirim. And so then he was back in Gaza, continuing to lead fighting against Israeli soldiers. We've had quite a number of these announcements over the past few weeks where they say they have managed to track down some of those that were directly involved in those deadly attacks of the 7th of October.
And what has been happening in Gaza overnight?
Well, I mean, just after the stroke of midnight ushered in the new year, there was a barrage of close to 30 rockets fired from Gaza aimed at southern and central Israel. So you can see footage of that with the interceptions of some of those by Israeli air defence systems. No one was reported to have been hurt. Meanwhile, I mean, in Gaza itself, there was intense bombardment by Israel. And a journalist who works with us in Khan Yunis, which is, of course, the focus of Israel's southern offensive, where Hamas leaders are believed to be hiding, told us that 25 people been killed, many injured in airstrikes. He'd seen the injured coming into the hospital. Otherwise, still very intense fighting going on in the centre of Gaza and in parts of the north.
And what's Israel been saying about how it intends to carry forward its military campaign?
So we had an Israeli military spokesman saying, basically in a kind of New Year message, that the Israeli war would continue throughout 2024 in Gaza, saying that the country's ready for prolonged fighting against Hamas, and that it's also doing forward planning and knows that there will be a need for other potentially fighting in the coming months. So it's for that reason bringing home some of the 300,000 army reservists. They're getting a break from the conflict, with Israel really trying to help its war-hit economy. And there's an Israeli official also saying that this is necessary to prepare for a possible widening of the conflict with Hezbollah, with the Lebanese armed group up in the north of Israel.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem. A court in Bangladesh has sentenced the Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus to 6 months in jail for violating labour laws. His supporters say the case is politically motivated. Celebrated around the world for helping millions of people out of poverty, Mr. Yunus is also known as banker to the poor. But at home in Bangladesh, he has a powerful enemy. He's been a vocal critic of the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina. Our reporter in Bangladesh is Akbar Hussain.
Many people believe that Professor Muhammad Yunus is the victim of conspiracy unleashed by the government. But the government always claims that Professor Muhammad Yunus, he violated the labor law in Bangladesh when he formed a telecom company. And there are some legal issues. And that's why some officials and laborers of the previous company, they took it to the Bangladesh's labor court. And after some extensive hearing, the labor court given him 6 months of imprisonment, along with other three officials.
Muhammad Yunus formed the Grameen Bank, for which he won the Nobel Peace Prize. Tell us a bit more about that bank and about the man himself.
Professor Muhammad Yunus, he founded the Grameen Bank in the early mid-70s when he was teaching at the Chittagong University. And at the same time, he founded the Grameen Bank. And the idea was that at that time, you know, 40 years ago, the Bangladesh's economic condition was very bad. Professor Yunus brought the idea that the people who are ultra poor, they should have some sort of, you know, rights to the credits from the bank, because the traditional banking system, they do not give, you know, loans to the poor people. That's why Professor Yunus founded the Grameen Bank. That Grameen Bank, it has been giving microcredits to the people, especially the women. Millions of Bangladeshis, especially women, their economic condition has changed a lot because of the Grameen Bank. Many people believe that in Bangladesh, that this is some sort of personal issues Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, she has Professor Muhammad Yunus, because Professor Muhammad Yunus is the most celebrated Bangladeshi around the world.
And, you know, he's quite old now and frail. What effect would a prison sentence have on him?
Professor Yunus is now 83 years old. And now, after the Labour Court verdict, he has every opportunity to challenge the verdict, and he can go to the High Court to challenge the verdict. His lawyers also said that they will appeal against the verdict. So let's see what happens, the legal process. But if he has to go to the jail and behind the bars, it will have some sort of negative impact, definitely, on his health. That's a matter of a big concern for his health.
Akbar Hussein. In Ukraine, President Zelensky has vowed to boost his country's military production. In his New Year message of resilience, he said Ukraine had become stronger as the war approaches its third year.
Our weapons, our equipment, artillery, our shells, our drones, our naval greetings to the enemy, and at least 1 million Ukrainian drones, all of which we will generously use on land, in the sky, and, of course, at sea.
Just hours after the message, Russia launched more attacks. In recent days, fighting has intensified in several areas across the country. The Russian installed authorities in the eastern city of Donetsk said Ukrainian shelling killed 4 people. Our correspondent in Kyiv is James Waterhouse.
It's a difficult period, I think that's fair to say. If you look at the words of President Zelensky, he is now looking inward, where he talks about this internal production of the military equipment Ukraine needs, not to completely liberate its territories, it still dreams to do, but to simply sustain its defence in the face of Russia's continued invasion. We've had a week where there were fears going into the New Year period that Russia was stockpiling missiles, in that it was saving them up for a sizable attack. And that moment arrived with Russia's biggest ever aerial bombardment of Ukrainian cities. And there's been a sort of deadly aerial tit-for-tat since, with Ukraine targeting the southwestern Russian region of Belgorod. Russia responded again. The aerial threat is the greatest it's been for some time, with its air defences for once getting overwhelmed in some areas. But of course, there is this very uncertain look ahead into the new year, where the last of the US-approved support packages has arrived. And Ukraine's ability to replenish its air defences, to keep fighting and keep defending itself is far from assured in the long term. It's a difficult time.
And of course, there must be concern in Ukraine that there's general war fatigue amongst many of Ukraine's allies.
Yes, that's already directly affecting Ukrainian frontline operations. Senior US politicians decided to go on their Christmas breaks instead of unlock a $50 billion support package. We've had Hungary block a similar offering from the European Union. And the issue with Ukraine, or for Ukraine, has been speed. It has either been, when it launched its counteroffensive in the summer, liberation came in the form of only a few kilometres here and there, in settlements reduced to rubble. And Ukraine has also had an issue with the speed at which Western support has arrived. It's not a problem with what has arrived, but what Kyiv always argues is that they should have had this kind of help before the full-scale invasion. So it's that lack of speed that has fed scepticism, certainly within the US Republican Party, where you have politicians wanting a quicker return on the billions of dollars they've signed off for Ukraine to date.
And what's the mood like amongst people in Kyiv, where you are?
The overarching emotion is fatigue. I think the weight of this war is deeply felt. People know people who are fighting. They know people who've been killed. There are men who are petrified at getting called up and finding themselves on the front line. And Ukraine's ability to defend itself so heavily relies on having that Western support. And if it was to stutter, then it could still lose this war. Russia could push again. This is what Kiev argues in the long term. It's an extraordinary story of survival already, but the problem for Kiev is it is not over.
James Waterhouse in Kiev. The war in Ukraine has highlighted the dangers faced by rail passengers. Now the state railway company has introduced women-only compartments on several of its long-distance sleeper trains, in a move seeking to protect women against assault and make them feel more comfortable at a time of war. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
Trains have a special place in the Ukrainian soul. They are affordable and reliable. So reliable that there are stories of them arriving on time despite Russian shelling. There's a whole culture associated with railway journeys in Ukraine. Because it's a large country, the largest in Europe in fact, such trips often take a long time and are often overnight in sleeper carriages. For generations, Ukrainians have bolstered such journeys with food, boiled eggs, chicken, and sometimes alcohol. And historically, trains were often seen as a place for socialising. And that's where problems start. Not everyone wants to socialise with fellow passengers, and some women have become targets of unwanted attention. In 2020, one woman was assaulted and nearly raped in a train compartment. Here she is, barely able to speak, shortly after the attack.
He grabbed me like this, and while I was lying down, he kept hitting my head with his fist. As I struggled, he told me, "Be a good girl or I'll hurt you more." I shouted, but no one came to help, even though I pummeled the walls.
The Ukrainian state railway company Ukrzaliznytsia is aware of the problem. And that is why it has introduced women-only compartments on four long-distance services so far. Yevhen Lyashchenko is the head of the company.
Of course, we have several incidents, and it's happening even before the war. It happens in the current situation. This kind of request is higher because the request to feel secure is higher than it was before the war. In general, women are looking for higher comfort because it is also not only security, it's also comfort.
Mr. Lyashchenko says a feeling of security is particularly important at a time of war.
You remember, everybody remember what difficulties and what stress millions of Ukrainians faced during evacuation. And believe me, for a lot of them, till now, this memory is still fresh. And of course, it is also another reason that they are looking for higher security.
Female passengers have generally welcomed the move. Here is Yaroslava.
If it's a reasonable person, I don't care if it's a man or a woman. But other women can be uncomfortable around men whom they don't know. I suppose it's possible. I welcome it because I understand that there's a need for it. Some women, but not me, have been on the receiving end of unacceptable behavior by men.
But some, like Victoria, are less convinced.
What if something happens to a man? An aggressive man can assault another man. That's not good either. Violence isn't always gender-based or sexualized. It can simply be some kind of an idiot.
Ukraine's railways have always been vital in connecting parts of this large country. And now they also offer a lifeline for refugees desperate to escape the war. The state railway is keen to make the experience as safe as possible, despite Russian shelling.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Still to come in the podcast.
Who's the leader of the club that's made for you and me?
A new year and new copyright rules for the most famous mouse of them all.
Who would kick off 14 of their best players to defend his racist dignity?
Unmissable stories from around the globe.
I get a call from the moral police They told me the general wants to talk to you.
The army asked us to leave the house immediately because it was going to be bombed.
Podcasts from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories, Lives Less Ordinary, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Jason Palmer, one of the hosts of The Intelligence, The Economist's daily current affairs podcast. The Economist's award-winning shows make sense of what matters, from our special series on China's president to our weekly podcasts on business, technology, and American politics. Our journalists provide fair, in-depth reporting on the events shaping the world. Search for Economist Podcasts Plus and sign up to our free one-month trial.
"2024 is set to be a big year as arguably the world's most important election takes place. The American public will be choosing a president. But before November's election, a series of contests within the opposition Republican Party will take place, known as primaries, to see who will take on the Democrat incumbent Joe Biden. That all kicks off in the state of Iowa on January the 15th. My colleague Rob Young got more on this from the BBC's senior North American reporter, Anthony Zurcher.
Candidates have won Iowa in the past. In fact, Republicans have won Iowa repeatedly in recent history and not gone on to win the presidential nomination. And part of the reason is that the electorate in Iowa does not necessarily reflect the electorate of the larger United States. It's older, it's whiter, it's more religious, more conservative. The importance of Iowa, however, is that it winnows the field. While it doesn't necessarily anoint the person who is going to be the ultimate winner, it definitely eliminates people who don't make any kind of headway in Iowa. There's a saying that there are three tickets out of Iowa. The top three finishers tend to make it on to the New Hampshire primary, which is next, and on to the primary campaign going forward. There are exceptions. Joe Biden did horribly in Iowa for Democrats in 2020, and he ended up winning the nomination. But particularly for the Republicans, I think that's a kind of a good rule of thumb.
And so by the time it gets to Super Tuesday at the beginning of March, will we know then who the Republican candidate is going to be? Or could it be even later than that?
In this case, looking at what's going on now, we should know by Super Tuesday. If you're gaming it out, there are two possible scenarios for how the Republican race plays out. The first one is the one that the polls are telling us. The polls are indicating that Donald Trump has an iron grip on the nomination, that he's going to win in Iowa, and he's going to win in New Hampshire, and he's even going to win in South Carolina, which comes later, and Nevada before Super Tuesday. And if he does that, if there's anyone hanging by their fingernails when it gets to Super Tuesday will be the knockout punch. Now, there's another possibility, and it's definitely much more slight, and polls don't necessarily bear this out, but it's that someone, either in all likelihood Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, or Nikki Haley, who's a former governor of South Carolina and the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under Donald Trump, that they do better than expected, that maybe one of them wins the Iowa caucuses in an upset of Donald Trump, and then Nikki Haley goes on, or maybe former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie wins in New Hampshire. And then all of a sudden, if those things happen, or even if they come a close second, then this might drag on a little more.
Anthony Zurcher. The new year has brought the end of most EU visa restrictions for people from Kosovo. It was the only country in the Western Balkans whose citizens did not enjoy visa-free access to EU member states. Here's our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay.
The new visa regime probably spells the end of a common sight in Kosovo's capital, Pristina, the long queues which frequently snaked along the roads in front of diplomatic missions. The German embassy even took on extra staff to deal with the tens of thousands of visa requests they received every year. Kosovo actually fulfilled the EU's requirements for visa-free access in 2018, but its citizens have endured a frustrating six-year delay to the deal's implementation. Brussels' bureaucracy and fractious relations with Prime Minister Albin Kurti's government both played a part. But the restrictions won't be lifted entirely. Five EU member states still don't recognise Kosovo's independence. One of them, Spain, will continue to require visas.
Guy Delaunay. Here in Britain, the spiritual head of the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has called on political leaders contesting elections this year to respect each other. Speaking to the BBC, he urged them to disagree passionately but not destructively. He was speaking in a televised New Year message. John Donison reports.
In the year he crowned a new king, Archbishop Justin Welby opens his New Year message on the coronation.
Hip, hip.
And at a time when headlines have been dominated by wars, much of the Archbishop's message is focused on the world's conflicts, first in Ukraine.
Wars seem everywhere at the moment. Wars we know about, wars forgotten. I've seen for myself the ongoing human cost of war. In Ukraine, I went to Bucha, where evidence of atrocities was found. I've met Ukrainian refugees, most recently in Georgia and Romania, families having to start again in a new country.
He also touches on the current conflict in the Middle East.
In Jerusalem last October, I sat and listened to some of those traumatised by war, Palestinian and Israeli.
In a special interview, the Archbishop urges politicians here and in the United States facing an election year not to focus on division and what he called wedge issues.
We have to say, my opponent is never my enemy. My opponent is always my fellow human being. We disagree profoundly. We disagree on incredibly important things, but they're human. We respect each other's dignity, their humanity, and the humanity of those who support them. And that is a decision by leaders. And I hope and pray that in this country they will forswear wedge issues.
Happy Christmas.
Archbishop Welby ends his New Year message to the country by wishing everyone a peaceful 2024.
John Donison. In 1928, Walt Disney released the first film to feature Mickey Mouse, a black and white animation called Steamboat Willie. And today, 1st of January 2024, is the day when, under US law, the original Mickey Mouse enters the public domain and is no longer subject to copyright. But Mickey hasn't totally escaped the company's control, as Vincent Dowd explains.
Steamboat Willie lasts just 8 minutes, but in 1928 it introduced a character soon to be world famous. Mickey Mouse sets off on a boat along a river, picks up a cow, is mocked by a parrot, and meets an early version of Minnie Mouse. There's no real dialogue, but the voices, such as they were supplied by the young Walt Disney himself. In the US, most films are protected under copyright for a total of 95 years. After that, they enter the public domain. They belong to no one and can be exploited commercially by anyone. Disney has for decades been very influential in shaping copyright laws in America, which is why Mickey at 95 coming out of copyright is a big change. But that's not the entire story. The image of Mickey used on TV in the Mickey Mouse Club from the mid-1950s had already altered a lot physically. It's only the original 1920s version which is now out of copyright. Anyone wanting to test the new legal position using a more recent version would be facing the power and wealth of an American corporation with a long-established interest in the world's best-known mouse.
Vincent Dowd reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Oblakwa, and the producer was David Lewis. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.